This is Ryan here for the Scale Up Show. I have Mark Roberge on part two. He is the original, or was the original CRO at HubSpot, took him from zero to 100 million, wrote the book, The Sales Acceleration Formula, is also one of the founders of Stage 2 Capital. So really unique perspective, specifically on native AI companies versus adapted companies, how to use it and go to market. We get deep on some things that he has a world premiere on that he's never talked about before with the science of scaling and specifically the AI relation to it and how it's affected it. So love, love, love this episode. I've talked about some things I've never talked about. He's talked some things he's never talked about it. So I think you'll enjoy it. Look forward to seeing you in the episode. How do you grow like a VC-backed company without taking on investors? Do you want to create a lifestyle business, a performance business, or an empire? How do you scale to an exit without losing your freedom? Those are the questions, and this show is the answer. Welcome, everybody, to the Scale Up Show. This is your host, Ryan Staley, and I have a very special guest with me today. I have Mark Roberge, who is on for part two, took HubSpot from zero to 100 million, did a lot of amazing things, wrote the book Sales Acceleration Formula, is also a professor at Harvard Business School. Mark, excited to go through part two with you of this episode, man. Crushed it on episode one.
Thanks, Ryan. I appreciate you having me back, and I'm glad we wore the same shirts.
Yeah, we wore the same shirts. Our hair's the same.
Yeah, just for continuity.
Yeah, it is. It is. But, you know, what we did on episode one is we're talking about, just as a quick recap, if you have not listened to it, go back in a time machine or in your Spotify, Apple, whatever, check it out. We were hitting on effectively like how to pick an AI company to work for, to invest in, to look at. And Mark dove into some really cool concepts. He broke apart some things that Jeff Bezos did to get basically a company ready for when the technology is ready to catch up with it. And so now we're going to progress a little bit and look at more of like AI native companies, specifically to go to market versus adapted companies. So I would love your take on that, man, especially because of all the due diligence you've done around trying to understand that at a deep level. So like walk us through, first of all, conceptually, just like kind of how you bucket companies like that, and then how you look at the strengths and weaknesses of kind of each model, if you will.
Yeah, there's a couple, because what we're trying to sift through is like, who are the real like challengers going to be? Like who are like, just like again in 1997, like which of these cloud-based companies are more like Alta Vista, like first mover, but doesn't capture it versus Google? You know, like who is like Netscape versus like, you know, Internet Explorer at the time. Now it's Chrome gets disrupted again, different reasons. And so, you know, there's a couple hypotheses in there. You know, one is that like one of the unique elements of the AI movement is this discussion about how data becomes the key piece, not like software or engineering capabilities, but who has access to the best and most data. And so as I look at businesses, I just ask myself, like, does the incumbent have it? You know, and, you know, like if we go, like I said in the last episode, I've been studying more of the go-to-market tech stack. So when I see things like SDR co-pilots, where it's like, we're going to help your SDR, like, you know, find 100 customers to call in seconds and then put together the personalized emails and voicemails and, you know, LinkedIn messages to execute a sequence. And I mean, like all the incumbents have that data, you know, that just doesn't excite me. Versus like, if you look at like a category, like an AI sales coach, you know, where it's like, you're picturing, you know, a lot of the incumbent, a lot of the bigger companies have talked to me about this. It's like, yeah, I'm hiring 70 reps this year. And some of them are actually pretty motivated and they want to get better fast, but they're dependent on my sales training team. You know, like they can't. And like, if there was an AI coach out there that they could run like 75 discovery calls against with no dependency on any sales enablement and trainer or manager resources, that really accelerates their ramp. And in fact, I can just like really rethink how I train my entire team. Now, how do you build that model? Well, you need like hundreds of millions of hours of video of managers coaching salespeople. Salesforce doesn't have that. HubSpot doesn't have that. Not even Gone has that. They have recording of sales reps talking to prospects. They don't have recording of managers coaching reps. I mean, maybe Sandler has it, but like, you know, I think, you know, and Sandler, their buddies, their CEOs, Dave Matson's an LP in my fund, all that kind of stuff. But like, he'd be the first to admit that it's hard for him to attract the best AI engineers out there. You know what I mean? It's just difficult. So it's like that. I think that's an interesting lens by which to look at opportunities. I think another one would be when you think ahead to like a mature AI world, when you think about that, does the workflow change so much that the underlying architecture of the incumbent is no longer relevant? So some people talk about like way out there, do you have AI buyers buying from AI sellers? Like, do you have AI bots that are evaluating the needs of your business, creating their own semblance of an RFP, pitching that out to AI sellers who are then matching it against their technology? How does that work? And does the underlying architecture of a CRM with leads and opportunities and stages and forecasts, is that still relevant? I don't know. Maybe, maybe not. If it's not, that's a big opportunity for a challenger, disruptor, AI native to take over a category. So anyway, just a couple of thoughts out there on the difference between that and like some of the stuff that I just think is like, just gets like merged into the existing player.
Yeah, it's a really good frame on that in terms of how to look at it. But let me ask you this though. So like, and I guess OpenAI didn't really come out of nowhere. They've been around for 8 years, but they didn't have any data. They just scraped the internet for all the data, right? Perplexity, same thing. They're starting to take off like gangbusters. Who knows what's going to happen, right? Google had the largest trough of data in terms of search and everything else, and they're struggling right now. So what would you say to those examples?
Yeah, they're challenging. I would say like, I don't know how far off Google was. They just didn't release it. I don't know. I'll just say what I've read. Okay. And you've read the same things.
Yeah.
And maybe some of the audience hasn't, which is like, you know, from what I've read, some people say that Google was relatively close. They didn't release it because they had concerns on societal impact. Okay. Other readings suggest that there was a cultural issue with Google in terms of like what they could develop, et cetera. Perhaps there were some innovator's dilemma, as you pointed out in the last episode. There's other arguments that like the best tech engineers out there don't like to go to big companies because at big companies, there's more red tape on building cool stuff. And there's actually less upside because the company's already huge. They'd rather go to an attacker where there's less red tape on building stuff. It's a cool lab like OpenAI was, and they can join with the companies worth $10 million and now they're worth $1 trillion. You know what I mean? So like, I think there's some arguments on why that would have happened. Now in the same vein, and this is again, not my own personal opinion, but just readings, a lot of writers suggest that there's a longer list of reasons why OpenAI is more like AOL than they are the next Google. You know, they've got a head start. They're worth a ton of money. They've built what like Bill Gates says, like the most impressive technology he's seen since like whatever Windows or something, you know what I mean? Like, and, but like they're being sued left and right through copyright infringement by like, you know, content providers. They use their content supposedly to train the algorithm without, you know, going through proper copywriting exercises. They've had tons of internal governance issues because of the unique governance they've set up of having a nonprofit with a for-profit underneath it. Their initial investors like Elon Musk and other folks are like, you know, don't really like what they're doing and feel like they're not abiding by their original mission statement. You got companies like Google and Microsoft and Meta who are very capable companies who are trying to open source their value proposition. And it's hard to imagine how they can defend themselves. Perhaps there's the application app marketplace is the answer to that, but the news says that it's not going too well. You know what I mean? So it's like, and also like if for the current investors to make money, they have to exit $1 trillion. That's a lot of money. Like, that's not like Microsoft and Google and Meta don't just like roll their eyes and let people have that. Like, they've allowed Salesforce to have CRM. You know what I mean? Like, it's just, that's a huge thing. So I don't know. This is what I'm reading.
Yeah, it's good. I mean, it's good perspective because like Microsoft's highly dependent on OpenAI right now, but you see them rolling a lot under the cloud umbrella of Azure with like Mistral, which is open source, and they're plugging a lot of other models underneath that as well. And then you could tell that's why they hired, I think, why they picked up Suliman, who is originally the founder of DeepMind, so then they could start their own Microsoft research division and then I think scale up their own model based on all the ones that they're leveraging. So that would be my take on it. I mean, they got the capital and the firepower to make it happen, right? They don't even need to depend on anyone. So it's just the talent. So I think that's good perspective, man. Let's talk about like one of your sweet spots, right? The science of scaling. I know that you've spoke a lot about that. And so can you just give like an executive summary on that? And then I would like to hear like the AI edition of that, right? Like the 2024 Mark Roberge update on the science of scaling.
Wow. A debut moment. No one has asked me how the science of scaling applies to AI.
Come on.
Nor have I even thought about it.
Seriously?
I mean, I know. This is the exclusive.
This is a world premiere right here. All right.
This is the world premiere. All right. So the science of scaling originated after the HubSpot IPO. I'd done 9 years. I was ready to rest. And I was fortunate that right around that time, Harvard Business School reached out to me and said, would you like to join the faculty and build out and teach our first sales courses? Like our students have an ever increasing interest in entrepreneurship. We need to ever evolve our faculty and curriculum, and sales is a huge part of this journey. I was like, wow, humbling. I'm like, not exactly the rest that I wanted, but for a couple of years, I won't have to be on like global, you know, flights and, you know, carrying a quota, I can just go do this. And that felt like an honorable way to give back with this gift that I'd been blessed with. So I did that. And what was cool about it is it allowed me to stay really active in the entrepreneur ecosystem in a very diverse manner. I was fortunate to stay in touch with the original venture capital backers of HubSpot, you know, folks at Sequoia and General Catalyst and Matrix. And they would tell me, hey, we just did the Series A investment. Would you like help them? Yeah, sure. Absolutely. So every quarter I picked a different company to spend a day a week with. I go over, I listen to gong calls, I look at their pitches, look at their salespeople, their hiring formulas, and just, you know, help them set it up. I did it with like 15 companies. Like some did really well, like Asana went public and Drift sold for $1 billion. Some were worth $1 billion on paper, some went flat, some went under, you know, the game. But it was just a cool time to see patterns. I just wasn't living 80 hours a week in one company. I was just seeing probably hundreds between like my experiences with students and all that stuff. And like, I was like, why do some crush it and some go flat? And a lot of those reflections came back to like when they decide to scale revenue and how fast. And that was like, I was like, you know what? We're not operating at a really advanced level on that. It's pretty kindergarten. It's like, it's just like, oh, this is what the past like $1 billion company did. So you just copy that. There's a lot of progression in terms of like product market fit. That's when we do it. But look up product market fit. What's the definition of product market fit? Ask 100 entrepreneurs what product market fit is. Like you get 100 different answers and most of them are based on revenue. I couldn't disagree with that. I disagree wholeheartedly with that. Right. So I basically created this science of scaling framework to help boards and founders calculate when they're ready to scale revenue and how fast. And you basically need product market fit and then go to market fit, and then you're ready to scale. And product market fit has nothing to do with customer acquisition and revenue acquisition. It has everything to do with customer value creation, which in a SaaS business is best represented by retention, which is unfortunately a lagging indicator. So you need to define a leading indicator of retention, what those in Silicon Valley call the aha moment, the moment of value, whatever you want to call it. It's just something that you could observe in the first month that's factual, that if it occurs, they'll be with you forever. And if it doesn't, they'll probably churn. Slack, 2,000 team messages a month. HubSpot, use 5 or more features in a platform, Dropbox, back your device up every day, whatever it is. Just like orient the whole company around that. And if most of your companies achieve that, you have product market fit. Beautiful. Then you're ready for go-to-market fit, which means you can acquire those customers profitably, unit economics, comp plans, pricing models, you know, sales playbooks. That's when it all comes into play. And those have to be done sequentially, because if you work on go-to-market fit before you've got product market fit, you might optimize your go-to-market on the wrong market and product. So you have to do them sequentially. And then once you're ready to go, you don't hire 20 reps in a month. You establish a pace. Two reps a quarter. And let's watch the leading indicators of product market fit and leading indicators of go-to-market fit. The leading indicators of retention and the leading indicators of unit economics. If they stay green, go to four reps a quarter. And then 8 reps a quarter. And now you're a unicorn and you did it in a very scientific, predictable way. Right? So that's the concept there. Now, how does that apply to AI? First time thinking about this. First time talking about it. That seems very obvious to me. We're in a hype cycle. Like we're about to get the first taste of like companies that had no product and revenue that raised at over $100 million that are going to go out of business because there's no traction. And we're going to like reflect back to this model, which is like, there's a sequential way to do this stuff. And we just need to be very aware of the phase we're in and align our team size, capitalization strategy, and North Star metric for the organization with that phase. And we've lost that in a hype cycle. So that's what I think. I don't know. Like, I haven't thought too much about uniquenesses of leading indicators of retention for AI. I mean, I have a couple AI companies in the portfolio. One is AI for support, and the lead indicator of retention are the percentage of tickets that use the AI to address them, like 70%. We also have AI for doctor transcriptions.
Okay. That's
and
huge
the
need there.
It's doing really well. That's a really cool like category. It's called DeepScribe. And the lead indicator retention there, if I recall, is the percentage of doctors that use the transcription on a daily basis. Okay. And it's really high right now.
Oh, I can imagine.
So like that, there's some examples, but I don't think there's like anything like AI dramatically changes the concept of science of scaling. I kind of think like the science of scaling will help AI as a guide as it comes out of the hype cycle and recovers into a sustainable disruption of the tech sector and then ultimately society.
Hello, this is Ryan here. Real quick, if you are enjoying this episode, please hit the subscribe button and leave a comment or review. If you want more help or just want to learn more about what the top SaaS CEOs and founders are doing, check out my website at www.ryanstaley.io. Join my newsletter, check out other free content resources I have there, and let me know if you want to scale your business. Now back to the episode. That's great perspective. And those are two good examples that you mentioned. And then obviously the whole breakdown was awesome. What I'm thinking about though is when I say AI, which is, you know, right, AI can mean a million different things depending on what you're focused on. I'm talking about the speed of innovation, right? Like how, like you mentioned, a month is like the timeline you want to look at for indicators. Is it now a week to 2 weeks, right?
Probably.
Like
that, a day, an hour.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of what I'm
probably
talking about.
That's a great point, Ryan.
Yeah. So
yeah, because PLG turned it into a day.
Yeah.
With Dropbox, et cetera, like just the adoption cycle. And I have to reflect on that one, but you're probably right. My first instinct tells me, of course, like development cycles get reduced dramatically. Sales cycles get reduced dramatically. There's tremendous talk of like, you'll have your first $1 billion companies that are run by less than 10 people. I mean, it's just like crazy. And that's a great point, Ryan.
That's going to be a part three. We're going to have you back as part three, and we're going to talk about that. You've had a chance to process it, man.
Right.
Because like, think about it. Like, here's where I'm coming from on this. Like, if you look at Midjourney is a 20-person company that's at $100 million in revenue. They didn't take any VC capital. Now, granted, I don't know how much they bootstrapped, I believe, but I think the founder had capital from a previous life, right? So maybe it was self-funded, right? But like, that's what I'm talking about. Like, and you know, I think Sam Altman mentioned, and maybe this is just all hype, right? But you know, eventually there's going to be, who's going to be the first, you know, one person $1 billion company, right? Which sounds insane.
Yeah.
But like,
probably right.
So that's where my head's coming from, is like the collapse timeframe from innovation. That's one, is like the speed. Yeah. The other is the cost. Yep. The cost of development's going way down, right? And the barriers to entry are way lower.
Way down.
So
yes,
we're going to reinvent.
And I'll go another direction on you, Ryan.
Yeah.
And we could, yeah, well, I'm going to go a different direction on you so we can come together and both think about this. But the counter argument to that is there have been very niche markets that could never be exploited because you couldn't get the R&D cost and CAC metric in line with the size of the market and their willingness to spend. And those markets are now accessible.
Ah.
So, you know, on one hand, we could argue that like, okay, because this stuff goes so fast, one person can generate $1 billion, $1 trillion companies. On the other hand, you can say, well, if you're a left-handed plumber that lives in Louisiana, we can build a product for you. And you'd want that product instead of the general, you know, services cloud app because it's built specifically for you. And so maybe instead of having like 10 people running around as billionaires, maybe we have 1 million people running 1 million different companies that generate $5 million each. I don't know.
Exactly. Yeah. Like lefties from Louisiana, we can call it, or whatever. Something along those lines.
That's the thesis.
But no, you're right. Like that's the other example, is like the micro products that are like a founder with a bunch of different micro products that are highly customized for specific niche markets. Yeah. So.
Right. And we see that play out a little less on the efficiencies, but market size. Like I spend a little time in Brazil. I've got some investors from there. I'm friends with a lot of investors and entrepreneurs down there. And what shocks me about down there is the scope of the product that works. You know, Brazil is unique. It's a big market. You know, I think it's the biggest in Latin America, but it also is the only one in South America that speaks Portuguese. So it makes it very unique and insular. And they have products like that have like the equivalent of QuickBooks plus Salesforce plus NetSuite as a single product that would never exist in the US. Like the market in the US is too big that we want a little bit of like specialization.
Mm-hmm.
But in Brazil, that's fine. And when they try to come here, it doesn't work. And maybe there's like an analog of what happens here is because those cost dynamics and addressable market dynamics change because of AI, that gets pulled out even more exponentially.
Love that, man. Well, I got one more question for you because we are almost up on time. Again, man, we just blow through our time. We blow through it quick. It's fantastic though, because you're coming back for part three potentially, right? That would be awesome, actually, to talk about it. Have you go in the lab and you cook up, you know, any kind of adjustments, and then you launch it. We could do a world premiere on LinkedIn or something like that. I don't know. Just a thought, man. Just a thought.
Sure. Well, we just did partially, but yeah, that would be great.
That's a mini one. So outside of that, my I'm curious on this, like how important do you think it is to integrate AI into your people?
Meaning co-pilots to make their job, or like physically put chips in them?
It's a good question. A good clarifying question. I hate the term co-pilot because I think it's massively overused, and there's a wide range of co-pilots, like as Dr. Evil would say.
Yeah, I know.
Laser, I know. Right? So my point is like, we're talking like basically using it for everything that they do or every part of their job, specifically on the go-to-market.
I think it's so critical. It's such an opportunity right now because the average person just gets like status quo. And the more you can push, that's what we're doing a lot with our portfolio because they're so busy chasing their quarterly numbers, like setting up the traditional tech stack. It's like the more, this is such an opportunity to get to reach beyond and spend the nights and weekends and study and figure out like how to embrace these things sooner. It's such an opportunity.
Love that, man. I'm seeing that too. And like one of the things that I think breaks people through that is when they see how they could save 10 hours a week and by learning something in a couple hours that sticks with them. And then that frees them up to try all the other stuff.
Right.
That's the game we draw.
But that's not the status quo.
No, you're right.
Like it's the top 5% that do it. So it's just like, I don't know. Everyone's so excited because we haven't felt this in like 20 years.
Yeah. It's true, man. Well, we're up on time. Where can people find you? Where can they find out more about you? And then we'll wrap things up, man.
Yeah. LinkedIn and Stage 2 Capital, Ryan. Yeah, I post a decent amount on LinkedIn. And you can check out our work at Stage 2 Capital as well.
Awesome. Well, if you haven't checked out Mark's stuff, check it out. He actually posted his full presentation on the science of scaling from South by Southwest, which he talked about, which was awesome. I checked it out before the show. Mark, it was a pleasure having you on again, even though we're wearing the same clothes. And appreciate you being on. And we will see you all on the next episode. Thank you for checking out the Scale Up Show. My mission in life is to help founders and revenue leaders avoid all the pain and suffering in revenue growth so they can flip it and create a life of their own design. So if you enjoyed this show, please like, review, share it on social, and more importantly, just share it with a friend. Share it with someone that you think could learn and benefit from what you heard on today. But the more we get the message out, the more people we could help, the bigger the impact we make, and the bigger the community gets, which helps everybody. So once again, thank you for being a loyal listener. I appreciate you and look forward to seeing you on the next episode.